Welcome to Optimizing, the podcast about leading Africa's digital future. I'm Professor Barry Dwalatsky.
And I am Karen Gammy.
Season 2 has the theme, Receiving and Passing the Baton. We're in conversation with people who have shaped or will shape Africa's digital future. Each conversation draws on the metaphor of life as a relay race. Our guests will talk about how they received the baton, who and what influenced them as they started life's journey. We will then discuss their own journey, how they nurtured and grew the baton in their hands. Finally, we will ask them about what it is that they will pass on to the next generation of leaders and experts. Today, we are in conversation with Cliff DeWitt. Clifford graduated in 1996 from Wits University with a degree in electrical engineering. And I guess my claim to fame is I taught Cliff up until 1996. His passion for computing led him into financial services, where he worked in a team that launched one of the world's first internet banking solutions in 1998 with Nedbank. He joined Microsoft in 2000, and in 2009, Cliff took on a director role, running one of seven segments within Microsoft South Africa. In this role, amongst other things, he developed and launched the South African BizSpark startup program, which mentored an incredible 3,000 startups. He managed the Microsoft relationship with South African universities. He also managed the DevOps business in South Africa. And he ran and keynoted several very important conferences, including TechEd, Dev Days, and Build Tour. Cliff spent 18 years at Microsoft, and then he decided to leave and start his own startup business in the digital space. And that's his current role as CTO and co-founder of a new digital business. Apart from this, Cliff holds two board positions at Wits University, on both the board of my center, the Joburg Center for Software Engineering, and the Tsimolohong Digital Precinct. Here he contributes both to his university, gives back to his university, and he helps individuals and companies in the industry. Cliff is also a regular contributor on The Money Show on Radio 702, so that's where you might have heard him. And on this talk show with Bruce Whitfield, he is invited a few times a year to contribute. He's also a keynote speaker, and he frequently speaks at developer and technology conferences. So, Cliff, thanks so much for joining us. We have based this podcast season on the metaphor of life as a relay race. Through your professional life as a leader within our local digital economy, you have carried a baton that really represents the knowledge and experience that you have gained on your long journey. And before we discuss passing it on to my co-presenter, Karen, who we'll introduce in a minute, and to her generation, can you discuss who passed the baton on to you? How did you receive this baton? So in other words, what was the young Cliff DeWitt like? Tell us about your heroes and the role models who shaped you both in life and in the world of digital technology.
Hi, Barry, and hi, Karen. And I think thank you very much for having me on the podcast. It's really exciting to be here. It's a great question, Barry, I guess. An interesting one, I suppose one that has some pause. My life journey was kind of interesting, right? Because I think as a young person at school level, I guess I always felt a little out. I was always sort of quite geeky and quite techie, and And although some of my teachers, I think, got me, I think certainly my peers at school honestly thought I was a little odd. I guess my role models in those days were, I think my family and certainly my dad and my uncle had a big influence on me. My dad, in terms of thinking independently and questioning the status quo. And my uncle was quite a big influence on me because he had a bit of a technology background, an electronics background, and he helped me kind of with my fascination for electronics and computers. So that was kind of my formative years. I must say, when I got to university, it was really an eye-opener because it was like meeting my people, if I could put it that way. It was I all of a sudden felt like I wasn't the strange person in the room, and I had a lot of people who thought and questioned the world the same way I did, and it was really a liberating experience. Wits was a great time in my life, certainly a formative years. And I think many of the professors, yourself and Professor Jandrell, were a huge influence on my way of thinking at that point in time. I think there I kind of got a deeper understanding of sort of the industry and computing. And I think if I were to call out sort of two people that really stood out for me at that time, I think to look at the work that Alan Turing did and how he pioneered computer science in the early days, and certainly his personal story really resonated with me in what he achieved, even under the circumstances of his lifestyle and the environment that he lived in. And then John von Neumann for me was also a very interesting person. Just very talented, obviously one of the last brilliant mathematicians of our era. And just what he achieved in his life were always really, really inspirational to me. So those were kind of my two sort of big computing heroes. I guess just to build on that a little bit, sort of in the modern world, I obviously I as you said in the beginning, I joined Microsoft. But even before that, I think Bill Gates was certainly a very big sort of, I wouldn't say hero, but I appreciated his position. And I think looking where he's gone today with the foundation, what I really admire about him is that, many people who make a lot of money just end up using their money for their own personal benefits. And I always admired Bill as a person for having, first of all, the ability to build an incredible company, but then the humility and the vision to start a foundation and invest back into society. So he certainly is sort of a corporate or a business hero of mine. And then if I could indulge you just on one or two more. Jeffrey Hinton, I think the father of modern AI. The more I read about him and the more I followed him, I really, really have a lot of respect for him. I think having the vision of what AI could become and what neural networks meant and being sort of trying for so long to get it right, sort of losing the respect of his peers and still being determined to prove himself right and eventually doing it kind of in the early 2000s. I think for me is really an interesting story of somebody with determination and what can be achieved when somebody really believes in what they do. The last thing I would say, and you kind of interluded it in your build up, is that I think many of us are influenced both by sort of heroes, but also by local mentors. And I have been very fortunate in my career to have some really incredible people mentor me and manage me. So I think just two that I'd like to call out. I think one that you've spoken to on this podcast, Mteto Nyati, was my manager for many years at Microsoft. And Mteto was really an incredible individual to work for. He really taught me a lot about myself, about respect for other people, about responsibility and leadership. And I really saw him as a mentor and a manager. And I was incredibly lucky to work for him. And he really did grow my career. And my last manager at Microsoft was a man called Zoab Hussein, and Zoab really is an incredible individual. I think he taught me the blend of being a good business person but doing good at the same time. Zoab still works and sits on the Mass Center board. He does a lot of social responsibility work, and really taught me a lot about, as I said, sort of the combination of the powerful combination of doing good while doing good business. So that's kind of just a summary of sort of my heroes and my mentors. And just I guess I've been lucky along my journey to have that.
So it's interesting that you talk about Turing and others and people you read about. And it kind of says that you're atypical of our normal of most of our engineering students who don't read much. When you were young, did you read a lot? Were you an avid reader?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point you raise, Mary. I read a lot, but I will say I'm not a great end-to-end book reader. I think I'm much more a curious reader. So I guess I embrace the internet reading philosophy more. So I've always been a big fan, I think personally, of understanding the bigger picture. And I think my fascination with Turing and with von Neumann and guys like Geoffrey Hinton is always kind of the questioning why we are here today. So I to be perfectly honest, I'm not great with biographies. I do read the odd one, but I find there's, we are spoilt for information these days. So I find myself often spending time behind my computer, sort of on Wikipedia, following articles and reading about the background without necessarily going and reading everybody's biography. So I guess I'm a strange reader. I'm a little bit more of a on-demand reader than I am to sit down on a Sunday afternoon and work through a book. And I guess that's just always been me. I guess maybe that is a little bit of the engineering side coming out than the more typical, but that's kind of the way I've stayed current.
Yeah, so there's been quite a lot written about Generation Z or whatever they are now, who read in a very different way. They don't read books from cover to cover. They read through hyperlinks. Does that ring a bell? Does that ring a bell for you, Karen?
Absolutely, yes. I feel like I have the attention span of a small dog, and like it's very easy to get into like a rabbit hole. So you read something, you're like, oh, that sounds cool, let's find out more. And it's just easier to do that in like a web sort of interface than just with a book.
That's very true.
So, Cliff, you're a person before your time.
Exactly.
So, Cliff, just to ask you a bit more about your background and the fact that you, as a WITS electrical engineer, and in fact, like many of our electrical engineering graduates, went on not to work in hardcore engineering, but in a bank, in IT in a bank, and then on to Microsoft. And how well did your WITS electrical engineering training prepare you for that world you went into?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, Prof. And I reflect on that quite often, actually, funny enough. I think, one thing I learned when I went to university was you had to learn was very quickly that it was not it's not about memorizing or spoon feeding the content that you have. And actually, a little later on, sort of third, fourth year, you realize it's not really that much about the content, but it's more about the process of learning. And I think once I understood that, it was actually an incredible learning platform because I think the thing I took away from engineering and my degree was that is the ability to learn and the ability to be curious and the ability to teach yourself. And I think once I understood that, it was incredibly powerful because yes, I think we all have talents and we all have places that we like to work and feel fulfilled. But if you don't have the ability to learn, I think you're going to be in a very dangerous position. And I think especially as the world moves forward, because I think we can argue that the ability to learn new skills and stay current is becoming an ever-increasing problem. And so for me, my university education at WITS was really, I look back on it and think of it was an education in how to learn, not so much in what it actually taught me in bits and bytes at that point in time. And I think when I understood that, it really was very powerful for me. I think it also taught me a lot of the softer skills, right? It also taught me, I think I mentioned in the beginning, that I sort of found my kindred spirit, if I could call it that, other people like me, who thought like me, who understood the world or looked at the world like me. And I think that is also incredibly powerful because you also realize that No person is successful or unsuccessful by themselves, right? I think you realize what it's like to be part of a team, how to rely on each other, how to work as a team. And that was also an incredibly powerful learning experience at my university days, and taught me how to work in teams. And I think puts you in good stead in any type of work environment, whether it's in a corporate or a startup, any of those environments. So yeah, it was really, really powerful.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Karen, in terms of your journey, how does this relate to how you got into digital?
So I think there's definitely some parallels in terms of like the non-linearity. So Cliff, maybe just for your benefit. So I'm a data scientist in the AI team at APSA. And my sort of academic training is in philosophy and economics, so not in one of the cool, sexy kind of STEM degrees. And then I somewhat organically kind of found my way into the job that I'm doing now. And so I guess I'm kind of curious to understand sort of how common was this air quote unconventional route in the like 1990s/early 2000s versus how common is it now?
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I think it's probably a little more common now. You know, the interesting thing about the way careers are evolving today is, you know, there is always sort of the prerequisites to do the job, right? So if you're going to become a developer, you need to know a little bit about development, right? Mm. But then there is the ability to learn on the job and the ability to bring a different perspective to the table. And I think certainly that was true even in my early days, right? I started out obviously with an engineering degree. I worked in a couple of real proper electronic environments. I spent some time in an offshoot of Dinnell called ATE doing real electronic design. But I always sort of had a desire to do software. I really like software was always like I thought as the I always gravitated to writing code rather than building stuff. And you know, my first job at Nedbank, I had never programmed in C++ real properly for a career. And I mean, I was lucky enough to be given an opportunity. So I kind of learned that skill on the job, right? I dragged along some of my formal training, but a lot of what I learned there was what I learned when I was in the environment. And I think that is true of a lot of things today. So I think a background like yours in some cases is really beneficial because it brings a perspective that some other people don't have around the table or in the team. And I think I talked about that earlier as well, the value of diverse teams. I think many software technology teams these days, just because of the reach of software, have to look at the social aspects, the people aspects, the consequential and the causal aspects. And I think having a diverse team, even though you're working on the same project, is probably not a benefit. I think it's essential these days.
You are singing my song. Yes, absolutely. Louder for those in the back.
So, Cliff, you moved on from being a developer to more senior positions. And in many cases, moving on to higher positions in the profession means moving out of technology. But given the work you were doing and your role at Microsoft, you stayed very involved in the tech side of things. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a bit about how technology has changed since the 1990s when I taught you. So at that time in the 1990s, what the developer had was a text editor, a compiler, and maybe a few libraries, and that was it. They developed everything from the bottom up. And at that time also, I was very involved in trying to bring the idea of object orientation to South Africa. And it was quite an uphill battle to convince people to use OO. And one of the ways that we tried to sell OO was about reuse. It was the idea of reusing big chunks of code. And if I look at software development now, it's all about reuse. So, and it's not only reuse of code, it's reuse of whole designs. And so I wonder if you could speak a bit about how the world has changed in terms of software development over these years from the 1990s to now.
It's such a great question, Prof, and one actually I think about a lot and have talked publicly about a lot. So I appreciate the question because the point of view that I have on this is kind of I like to go back to simple analogies, and I use the analogy of Lego. I think when Lego first started out, there really were just a bunch of building blocks, right? Lego kind of started with blocks. And if you bought a pack of Lego as a kid, you got a pack of blocks, and you could get some red ones and some yellow ones. But really, what you built with those blocks was your imagination. So you got the blocks and you put it together. And I think that kind of is a great analogy for sort of the formative years of software, where you had a language, you had maybe a couple of APIs, but you really needed to build the stuff pretty much yourself. As these things matured, things started evolving and people's demands started evolving. So if you look at Lego, and I like to use my kids as an analogy. So I've got a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old, and if I look at their Lego today, my 13-year-old's playing with some robotic Lego, and my daughter is playing with her Lego friends. And those Lego packs that they made today are quite specific, right? They come in a pack, and they have some very special blocks like windows and doors and things like that, very specific characters, and that allow you to build something quite specific. And I think that's kind of where software is going. It's becoming more and more specific. So we make that a little bit more concrete and kind of look at the way the world is working. I think your vision on object orientation and reuse is really becoming kind of almost mainstream now. And I think nothing has done more to sort of drive this in the last little while than that of the cloud. So if you look at what the cloud has done for many software developers, is it's really kind of turned things into platforms, as we call it. So now I think software developers, and the term software developer, maybe even in its own definition, is becoming a very, very broad term. Because if you look at all the kind of different categories of software development now, at the highest level, many of the big vendors now, and many of the big sort of software institutions and some of the universities are starting to talk about the concept of a business developer, where you don't even have to understand a language, but you can describe a problem, sometimes visually, sometimes with a bit of pseudocode, and start to create a software solution through composition. So visual design frameworks to define a business problem and define a piece of software to solve that business problem. Incorporating things like a little bit of robotic process automation, a little bit of workflow, a little bit of a user interface that's simply composed through drag and drop can be used to solve many, many business problems. And so that's kind of at the top end. Then if you kind of drop a level below that, there's this concept of the cloud developer. And the cloud developer of today's world really is in some ways just composing solutions. They're using these high-level building blocks that the cloud today offers, and it's very, very rich, right? So if you look at what the big software vendors are doing today, they're providing these really amazing capabilities, but wrapped up in a cloud service. So you can step up to the Amazon Cloud and get a document recognition service that does a really good job of OCRing, understanding the form, and just providing you the data. That would be a really, really tough problem to solve if you had to just create that service. But as a cloud developer, you can just simply step up and use that and compose a solution using these high-level building blocks straight out of cloud services.
It's so wild that you actually use that example of AWS's like text recognition service or Textract, because that's literally one of the problems we're facing at work. Is like we have an OCR problem that we're trying to solve, and we've built like an in-house solution in order to do like our due diligence. Like we obviously want to test and compare it to stuff that's out in the market, and like there's a whole AWS that does a really fantastic thing. And the only thing that we as like data scientists really need to know is like how best to use APIs, which is a little bit like, what is the point of our jobs right now? So that was an interesting example that you used.
It's such, it's exactly, Karen. And I think that's, in some ways, you know, it evokes so many questions, right? You said it right now. It's like, well, if we aren't creating the service, what is our value? And it's, yep, it's such an interesting question, that, because I think it brings us back to some South African sort of, I guess, biases. And I think we're as a development community are very heavily biased by not invented here syndrome, or I don't own it, therefore it's not good enough syndrome. And I think, honestly, sometimes that holds us back, right? Because if we were to embrace those services, you know, under the right economic situation, so we need to make sure that it works for us from a business point of view, there is a tremendous amount of other value you could add to your organization or to your startup, because, you know, those things are really becoming utility. There's no competitive advantage these days in creating a better, you know, OCR service, because there are people who literally have doctorates and PhDs and spend all their lives building those services. You're never going to do it better than they can, but you will understand your business much better than they ever will. So if you can use those services, you can create a competitive advantage for your organization.
Definitely. That's the way. Which is exactly the point you were talking about, you know, the diversity of skill sets and thinking, because it doesn't help to just have people who have like the algorithmic prowess. You got to have all the other stuff too. That makes sense.
Exactly. And look, and I guess that's also why I made the comment that I think the world of the developer, the term developer, is becoming very broad now, because yes, I think there are some of us who will just simply consume cloud services and compose them. But that's not to undermine that if somebody really wants to work on an operating system, there are still a role for low-level developers who want to spend their days creating operating systems or working on actually, you know, day and night producing the next greatest AWS or Microsoft Azure OCR recognition engine. Absolutely, those roles exist. They just become a lot more specialized and a lot more deep. And I think that's, I guess, in some ways, the diversity that and the opportunity that we have. The role of the software developer is really becoming as diverse as a business developer creating a business solution, or a really low level, probably C++ assembler developer who really wants to work day and night on making the next best operating system or kernel. That's the breadth of the opportunity we have as software developers, which is fantastic, right?
And so you've kind of touched on it quite broadly and quite well as well. But like, obviously, you know, there are skill sets that are required by like, you know, AI and in this environment, versus kind of the skill set that was required for like a Java developer kind of back in the day. And you've spoken about like, you know, needing to have like kind of your business hat on as well when you're doing like, you know, AI as well. But in terms of like kind of the specific technical skills that you think data scientists or AI developers or whatever we're going to call them, what do you think that looks like right now?
So I have an interesting perspective on AI, and let me start with kind of my simplistic definition, and Karen, keep me honest. So, but this is how I like to think about it. You know, in the good old days, and you kind of use the Java developer analogy, right? In the good old days, developers were like the role and what the code did was reasonably well understood. You kind of had a problem. Somebody gave you something and said, okay, I need a program to do A, B, and C. And then you chose your platform, you chose your language, and you wrote a computer program that solved that problem or did that thing.
Sure.
And the machine did exactly what you told it to do. It was, in my world, the way I think about it is it was deterministically correct, right? So you told it what to do and it did it.
Hundreds.
I think the world of AI fundamentally changes the way we think about software, because if you think about the process of creating an AI algorithm, what you're really doing is you're taking a model and then you're collecting a bunch of data and you're choosing a model that's specific to the problem you want to solve. And now you're training that model with data and you're telling that model, you know, what is correct and what is incorrect. And through that training process, you are effectively creating an algorithm. Mm-hmm. The challenge, though, is that you are not deterministically creating the algorithm. The algorithm is getting trained by the model. The neural net is adjusting its biases and creating a model that can solve your problem. Yep. But the big challenge with this is that you are, as the developer in quotes, or the data scientists, are simply facilitating the training of the model. You're not actually writing the algorithm. And so I think the skills that are required in some way are similar, but in some ways are fundamentally different. Because now you need to think very carefully about where your data is coming from that you use to train your model. You need to think about the data set and is it representative of the problem that you want to solve? You need to think about things like bias in your data set. And bias can be, bias can be a very deceptive thing. You may think you have a very, very well represented data set, but it could cut out, data from a geographic area, a race group, a population, a certain population, which would radically alter the algorithm that you produce. And I think there's been many documented examples of bad training data
100%.
causing bad algorithms. I also think it's become a lot more of a social skill, and hence I think your formal background is very advantageous in that once you've created the model, you need to question the model. Because one thing that I think a lot of deterministic programmers really battle with is that the concept of the model is a statistical model. So now this thing has a probability of being correct. It's not guaranteed, it's not statistic, it's not deterministic. It'll give you the answer, but the answer is a probable answer. And that probable answer may be good enough in some scenarios, but not good enough in other scenarios. And so I think this skill of questioning the model, questioning the algorithm, not just once when you create it, but in a ongoing supervisory way is a critical skill to have when you're working in the AI space. So I think we're just kind of scratching the surface here, but kind of I think you can hear that certainly from my perspective, the role of the data scientist in programming, although you're kind of still solving problems, you're doing it in a very different way. And I think the skills that you have to have, and certainly the big picture thinking that you have to have, I think in some ways quite different from the traditional sort of deterministic way of problem solving.
No, I feel you. That totally makes sense.
And this is such an important point. I think I came to a meetup that you spoke at, Kieran, and this whole issue of explainable AI came up. And it's about not just accepting what we're told, what recommendations come from the AI, but rather to expect the AI to give us a reason why it came up with a recommendation. And of course, that's a much harder problem. You don't just throw data at the algorithm and get an answer. You have to build in some way to say why you got to that answer.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Correct.
This is a really interesting discussion and one I'm sure we could go on for much longer, but I'd like to turn a bit to skills, and I know you've touched on some of this, Cliff, but you and I have long been passionate about digital skills in our economy, and it's something we've worked on together. And I'd like to ask what your thoughts are in terms of how the modern developer should go about getting skills and what skills they should get. And given what you've said, I'll put the term modern developer into quotes and the modern something, but how should such a person get skills and what skills would they need?
Yeah, as you said, Prof, I think we've spent a bunch of time working on that. My opinion on that is that I think first of all, for the person wanting to become that modern developer, I think they do need to think about their passion, right? I think people entering this world, and I think Karen's a great example of somebody who may not have had a formal training in that world, but there's something that obviously drew you into wanting to solve problems, the fascination of AI. I'm sure, Karen, that was something that was inherent in you, right? Nobody taught you that. You were kind of drawn to that world. And so
Definitely.
to me, that passion piece, that curiosity, that willing to want to be in that world is really important. I am a firm believer of you will do well if you have a passion for what you do. And I think so that is a skill that I think is required but can never be taught. I think it's just a measure. And I think once you have that, there are lots of opportunities these days to gain formal skills. I think I think depending on the path you've chosen, we spoke at length at the beginning about how the role of sort of this modern developer is becoming very broad. You know, everything from, let's call it the business composer down to the operating system developer. I think, you know, no person knows right at the beginning exactly what they want to do. But certainly, I think to start, you know, at a certain point and finding and having access to skills at that point is really important. One of the things that I learned and one of the programs I put in place at Microsoft was this concept of sort of learning through mentorship. And so we built a program called the App Factory, and I think we placed the very first App Factory that we built at the JCSC with Prof at the time, was this concept of taking people who wanted to become developers and then teaching them through practical immersion. So maybe somebody had a degree, maybe somebody didn't have a degree, maybe somebody had gone to Vega, and these are all real examples of people that we put through the App Factory. We put them into a program with a bunch of other like-minded people and some mentors, and they just wrote code all day and they got feedback on how they wrote code. They took on real-life projects and were mentored through that. They had a bunch of time to do self-learning, and I think in today's age, the access to information you have in the internet is just so incredible, where you really can figure out most things yourselves. But in that program, we built several hundred very successful software engineers. And that just proved to me that with the right mentorship, with the right feedback, and with the right mixture of practical immersion and mentorship, you can really produce a very, very good software engineer. But I come back to the point that the people that we chose had passion for what they did and how they worked.
Yeah, I think that's such a key point you make. And if we talking about handing on the baton, I think that's really one of the key learnings that you and I have spoken about. But to be brutally honest, I think looking at our national skills pipeline in the digital space, I think it's broken. I think our skills pipeline is broken. And what would you say needs to be done beyond the specific example you've given us of the App Factory, but what more generally could be done by corporates and government to fix our national digital skills pipeline?
Yeah, again, Prof, it's a great question, and I think I do share your thought that that we really need to do something. Look, first of all, I think there is an onus on our formal education environments, both at the school level and at the tertiary level, I guess, to think about the type of skills they're producing. I think maths and science is really important in any of these technical sort of skills, and I think having a good solid foundation is certainly the entry point in many cases of learning. Sort of post that, I think kind of you get into the world where people have skills and the base skills, but how do they get better at kind of finding a career and a path? And as I talked about previously, one of the things we did with our App Factory project is that we realized that in order to invest in building the next generation, you actually have to take some time and some effort to mentor and grow people. And our philosophy there was pretty simple, right? If you actually give people the time to have proper mentorship and give them access to the ability to self-learn, we had the thinking is that people would grow in an accelerated way. And we certainly proved that. I think with the right access and with the right mentors, people who have a passion accelerate their growth. And so I think there is a responsibility on corporates and certainly the work sector to really take this concept of internship seriously. I think in many cases, interns are sort of left on the side, being given menial pieces of work to do, and really don't get much attention from the senior people in the organization. And therefore, their learning is slow, and often they get cited for being not growing quickly enough, etc., etc. But we certainly proved that if you give people the right, put people in the right environment and give them the right feedback, you really can accelerate that growth. So that's the one thing. I also think, coming back to your comment about the environment, I do think we need to start looking critically at the type of skills we are teaching our children in the formative years, right? I think kind of having a broader exposure to the way certainly technology is going, computing is going, and teaching people to think themselves, to research themselves, and giving them the tools and technologies to do that is critical. And one of the reasons I'm quite passionate about that is that I think in some ways our world is at an inflection point. I think to be digitally inclusive going forward and to be seen as a country in the digitally inclusive world, these are going to become base, almost infrastructure skills requirements. And so if we don't get serious about this and think about how we equip our next generation of workforce to play in this world, I fear that we may be left behind. You know, the world is very quickly moving from what we would call a resource economy, when in many cases South Africa could rely on the fact that we produced a large amount of gold and had very successful, you know, industrial operations, to participating in the information age. But to participate in the information age means that you have a society that produces, and it certainly can equip its citizens to participate in the information age. And I think that's a large part of what we have to think about as a country, is how do we equip, you know, our future generation to participate viably in the information age. And a lot of what I'm talking about in the education side really is those skills, so that we can participate as a first world citizen in the information age of the world, and not just be left behind as a country and kind of be left on the bottom end of the continent as a resource, you know, where the rest of the world is really only buying resources from us so that they can participate in the information age. That's my biggest fear.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I really like that. I know that you've done some work with a company when you were at Microsoft, obviously, called BizSpark, right? Which sort of supported a bunch of startups. It's like more than 3,000, or like a really ridiculous number. Can you tell us a little bit more about like what it was, like the work that you did, some of the success stories? Because I think that ties in quite nicely with this responsibility that you're talking about, at least on business. So that sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's a great lead in, Karen. Thanks. Yeah. So we started with this App Factory concept where we taught young people to be developers. But the kind of the next logical step, if you're going to think about sort of how a country thrives in the digital age, is how does it think about innovation, and how does it think about startups? And you can read many, many books, and certainly it's true for South Africa, is that, you know, the SMME sector, the self-employed sector, really is the biggest employer in the country by a long way. So if you can help sort of people create their own jobs, be self-employed, start their own businesses, that is honestly the dream of many growing economies. Yeah. So one of the things we were lucky enough to do when I was there was we put a proposal in front of the Jobs Fund and said, we think we have some latent potential in the country in terms of software startups. And we partnered with the Jobs Fund at the time and a bunch of accelerators and incubators in South Africa to run that program. And our thinking really was, if we could find entrepreneurs and support them to take their ideas to market, help them starting their businesses, that would be a really cool thing. And so our program was really completely focused on software startups, on entrepreneurs, giving them a bunch of free software, giving them, you know, a bunch of free cloud resources, and then partnering with incubators and accelerators to help them with things like business mentorship, legal mentorship, you know, all the things that are really, really tough when you're a standalone business or a business of two or three people trying to get yourself off the ground.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it was a really cool program. You know, we mentored a whole bunch of businesses. Many of them didn't make it. Quite a few of them made it. You know, lots of them made it. And we kind of had the philosophy that the success would come from the entrepreneurs that we taught to run their own businesses, The interesting thing about entrepreneurship is that you don't always succeed, but you always take your skills with you, even if you fail. And so we kind of also had the philosophy is that even if the businesses fail, we're teaching the entrepreneur skills to go and open their next business or even go and get a job at a corporate, because they are much more well-rounded individuals now. They've learned how to write software. They've learned how to run a business. Getting a job would be so much easier for them. And so we had a whole bunch of successes. You know, we had a bunch of companies come out the top of that, launch successful apps, produce successful solutions. But in many cases, I think about the success personally as the people we touched and the people that learned how to run businesses, learned how to start there and run their own environments. And even if they chose not to do that afterwards and go and get a job, I still see that as a success. And I think in many cases, that is the catalyst we need. I think if we can help young businesses get off the ground, unlock the innovation that we know is here, right? We live on this continent. We know how creative people are, how clever our people are at creating solutions. I mean, we are surrounded by people who come up with innovative solutions for the problems that we face. And if we can build a culture of kind of getting like-minded people together to commercialize those solutions, I think we'd be very, 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 very well placed on the world stage.
Yes, and I have to say congratulations to you and your team at Microsoft for programs like BizSpark and App Factory. They certainly moved the needle. And then 2 years ago, you did what some call eat your own dog food or drink your own champagne when you left a very good job, a great job in the corporate sector, and you decided to go out and start your own startup. And I wonder if you've got any words of advice or anything to say to people who do take that very brave step of moving out of the corporate world and into their own startup.
Yeah, again, great personal question. Thank you, Prof. I guess you said it right. I think when you're in a corporate environment, you run these programs, you give a lot of advice, but there's nothing like being on the other side. And I'd always wanted to run and build my own business. It was kind of a passion of mine. And a colleague of mine who I'd worked with for many years at Microsoft and I eventually decided to do that together. Our current business is probably going to shut itself down, and we're busy starting a new one. So I guess my first lesson in startup world is that you really need to learn to roll with the successes and the failures, and you need to make decisions quickly on what works and what doesn't work. It's a super interesting journey because you learn very quickly when you start your own business that it really is all about what you can do or you and your team can do, and that you learn very quickly about the responsibility you have and the breadth of the job. Certainly smaller startups, people do all jobs at once, right? So you may call yourself the CTO, but you're also the network engineer and you're the administrator of the chairs and you worry about cash flow and all of those things. So one of the things in a small business that you learn is that, you're a very closely knit team and you really work together on pretty much everything. But the freedom you have running your own business is super interesting. It's liberating in some respects, and you realize that you can make decisions very quickly and move very quickly. And I guess that's some ways why startups are successful, is that they're much more agile than corporates could be. And Karen talked a little bit about some of the ways she made decisions and investment committees and things like that. Startups, you just make those decisions in 5 minutes if you need to sometimes. Mm-hmm. I guess from an advice point of view, I think if you have an itch to be an entrepreneur, you want to try it at some point in your life. I think it's an incredible experience. I think you get to work on some really interesting projects. And there's nothing like something being really personal until you own it and have responsibility for it yourself. So there's a lot of great personal energy you take around doing a startup. I guess on the negative side, it's quite risky. So certainly in today's environment. But I think maybe, you know, I was reading a bunch of stuff the other days about the age of most successful entrepreneurs, and it seems that most successful startups are run by people who've had a couple of years of experience in the corporate world, just to kind of hone those skills, build a bit of capital, maybe that they can afford to do that, and then go and give it a go. So I would say, you know, give it a go if it's in you. Just don't be naive about don't think it's going to be the same environment as you do have in your sort of in your corporate job, because it is very different.
Yeah, and that's such good advice. And I can't remember who said it, but someone said, if you've been in 100 failed startups, you don't think of it as failed startups, but it's 100 learnt lessons. So every rock in the road is a lesson learnt, and that's a good piece of advice.
Absolutely, and I think in some, you know, if you read books about startup cultures in both, you know, Silicon Valley and Israel and some of the Eastern countries, that mantra string is very strong around, you know, wanting to have people who've been there, tried it, and maybe not always succeeded, because that's where your life lessons come from, right?
As someone who is like not necessarily an entrepreneur themselves, but is very sort of admiring of entrepreneurs, I think, yeah, a lot of what you speak to is also just the thing about like spirit and character and the way in which you carry yourself, even if it's not necessarily for the purpose of starting your own business. So yeah, I think that whole idea around like, you know, the way in which you shift your perspective from like, oh my gosh, I failed a million times versus like, oh my gosh, I learned a million times. What a wonderful and fulfilling experience.
Yeah.
I think just makes things.
Yeah.
Makes doing life easier.
Yeah. No, and it's such an interesting comment, Kieran, because I think maybe that's also a little bit of a South African thing. I think sometimes,
sure,
and in some ways a corporate thing, is that sometimes we're so afraid of failure, we won't take a risk. And I think sometimes that can be your biggest challenge to being successful, both in a startup world, but also in a corporate world, right? I think
Absolutely. If
you're given the freedom to try something, even if it fails, you will learn a lot. I think what we need to do is give people the ability to fail without being branded as a failure, and we'll have a lot more innovation.
Exactly. Yeah, because the goal is not to not be scared. It's to be scared and still do the thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Cliff, we're coming to the end of our discussion, and I'd like to just broaden it out a bit. And you've not only been part of the South African software and digital economy, but you've also had quite a lot of involvement across Africa and across the world. And I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of how our South African digital ecosystem compares with that in the rest of Africa and internationally.
Yeah, it's a nice question, Prof. If I were to summarize it, I would probably say that I think South African sort of participants in the software space or the digital space tend to be really good broad problem solvers. I think just because of the nature of the number of skills that we have, our exposure to lots and lots of different types of technologies, I find the South African developers tend to be really, really good breadth understanding developers. So they know a lot about a lot of different things. That being said, if I contrast us to some of the continental players, I still think we hold ourselves very well in terms of our skill set, our innovation, our technology understanding with much of the continent. There are definitely pockets of excellence if you look at sort of what's happening in Kenya, maybe some of the work that's happening in Rwanda. So there are definitely pockets of excellence in the continent. But I think in general, if you look at across the continent, I think South Africa still carries itself incredibly well in terms of the quality of the skills that we have. If I contrast that to sort of my experience working in a multinational and look at sort of some of the international devs, I think what tends to happen, because the playing field is much bigger and the skill set is much bigger, I found that people specialize much quicker. And therefore, you get people with much deeper skill set, but because they're deeper, they're not as broad as our South African developers. And that's a pro and a con in some respects, right? Because, I would often interact with some of the product teams at Microsoft, and I remember people who had spent speaking to one guy once who'd spent his entire career working on the print spooler in C++ of the Windows operating system. That defined his career. So there was nothing you couldn't tell this guy about how the print spooler worked. But as soon as you raised the conversation above, what was happening on the cloud, he had no idea. So it's kind of interesting to see how the depth and the specific focus breeds, real specialism or a real speciality, but it also has a negative point. And again, having bunch of people who've worked for me move overseas and work in product teams. That's the one kind of consistent comment that I've heard, is that they've had to specialize in a very in an area and become very good at that. And the last kind of point I would tease out is that I think just because of the size of our market, we're not always exposed to the size or the scale of some of the computing that we do see overseas. So another guy who used to work for me now works at Amazon, works on some of the video streaming technology. And sometimes when I talk to him about the number of users he has on his system, and it's absolutely mind-blowing, right? I mean, they're talking hundreds of millions of users at any point in time. And so I think sometimes we don't always see the breadth or the scale of what computing solutions have or the impact that they have. And I think that's just a factor of the size of our market. So if I were to kind of summarize it, that's the way I think about it. But in general, I find South African developers, just because of our training, our background, and our kind of can fix it all sort of culture, to be really, really good problem solvers. And I still maintain to this day that problem solving is probably the biggest requirement you need to be a good software developer.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And as you know, we at the JCSE do an annual skills survey, and what it has consistently shown is that a typical South African developer or digital professional will do a range of jobs in the software development or system development life cycle. So they might do some design, some development, some testing, some project management, and that's all wrapped into one person, and at the same time they would work in different technologies and different parts of the technology stack. And this isn't typical of developers in most other parts of the world, so we do have very different digital professionals locally.
Yeah, spot on.
So we come back to our metaphor of life as a relay race, and we've heard how you picked up the baton, how you've done really well in carrying it through life's journey. And although your race is still far from done, what would you say if you were handing over your baton to Kieran and her generation of engaged digital professionals? What advice would you give them?
Yeah, nice question. Thanks. I guess just kind of speaking, sort of, and thinking about that question as you were posing it, I like to think about it the way I structure some of my mentorship sessions with the people I still work with. I think my number one feedback to lots of young people today is just believe in your own abilities. I find sometimes, like, we're often held back by our own, like, it's our own demons inside us that said, I'm not good enough, or I'm not sure about this. And I think once you cross that divide, once you cross the syndrome of believing in yourself deeply, you really, really can achieve incredible things. The The other thing I think about a lot, and I guess this is a personal life lesson that I try to impart often, is that many young people coming into, especially into larger organizations, often believe that their leaders have all the answers. They believe that their leaders have many years of experience, and that the guy running the company is an incredible genius. And, you know, if you could speak to him, you could ask him any question and he would give you any answer. And some of the realization I had moving up the ranks and eventually becoming a leader in an organization is that you don't always have all the answers. And that I think young people in the organization, it kind of comes back to believing your own abilities. If you believe passionately in something, you know, you probably in the area that you work in your organization, probably know more about the problem you're trying to solve or the job you're trying to do than your manager or definitely than your manager's manager. And if you have the confidence to believe in that, you can drive towards things that you believe in and deliver results that are incredible. Don't always ask for permission, right? Of course, there are times when you need to ask for permission, when you need to spend a bunch of money or you need to do certain things. But don't always, as a young person, think that the leader has all the answers. Sometimes you have more answers than the leader, and you should take responsibility in doing that. The other thing that I personally feel very passionate about is question the status quo. So, you know, I think sometimes, again, it's a product of the way we brought up sometimes, is that you're in an environment and it works the way it works. But I think people who question the way it works, ask questions, listens to answers, often come up with ways of working and doing things that are not the normal, right? And that's where the amazing stuff happens, right? Where you have the strength and I guess it comes back to believing in your own abilities again, to kind of ask people, well, why do we do it like this? Well, because it's always been done like that is not a good answer, right?
Yeah.
So I think it kind of leads with understanding the bigger picture, but I think questioning for me is a skill that is often not used enough. I think we often expect to be told what to do and we do it. And I think we should question more. And the last two things that I'm really passionate about, the one that's very big for me is humility. I find often, certainly when people start having a little bit of success, they really get full of themselves quite quickly. And I think that is a quality that I really, in my opinion, I really dislike. I think people who remain humble, irrespective of what they achieved, who take the time to thank the people they work with, to acknowledge their colleagues, are people who will go much further in life. I think, you know, understanding the environment that you work in, your colleagues, and your colleagues are not always just your direct team, right? It's the tea lady who works in the tea room. It's the cleaners who work in your building. I think having the humility to understand that team that you work in, acknowledging those people and seeing them as part of your team is really, really important. And the last piece of advice I have is don't be impatient. I think one of the things that I think today's generation is probably guilty of is this concept of instant success or instant gratification.
Yep, guilty as charged.
So I knew I might touch it over there, Karen. But if you think about it, if you think about people who really are successful, in many cases we see them in the lights and the shine and the glitter when they've achieved something big, but we don't see the years of hard work or all the effort that put in. And I come back to my Geoffrey Hinton example, right, of him kind of believing in AI and the neural net as a concept for so many years, being knocked down by his colleagues, but he had the determination to do it. And now he's the hero of AI, right? Yeah. So now everybody puts him up in lights. But if you look at what he had, he was not impatient. He knew that he was on the right track. He believed in it. And he did something that was worth doing. So my last piece of advice is do something that's worth doing. Don't be impatient about it. Have the fortitude to see it through and your success will come.
That's such great advice. And Karen, what do you think of those batons?
I mean, I'm just trying to sprint up and catch it. Yeah, it sounds good. That's really good. I like that. Thank you so much.
So, Cliff, thank you so much for your time and thank you for being part of our podcast. And I wish you luck going forward in your next startup or your next umpteen startups. And it's been a pleasure working with you, and I hope we carry on doing that for a long time as well.
Thank you, Prof, and thank you, Karen. Thank you for the conversation. It's really inspiring.
Thank you.
This podcast is a Grand Geeks production. It is produced by Professor Barry Dwalatsky and edited by Evan Wigdorowicz. It is presented by Professor Barry Dwalatsky and Karen Gammy. Music is done by Callum Cool and logo design by Evan Wigdorowicz. The companion website is at www.softwareengineer.org.za.